I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man.
Testing. Welcome to Barnstorming PA. This is a podcast. We call ourselves boldly progressive, proudly rural. We explore this theme with interviews and what we call artisanal conversations. My name is Taylor Lightman. I'm your good co-host, co-producer of the show. My compatriot Jordy Comas is out in the field today, so you just have me, and we're going to be interviewing future Congresswoman Amanda Waldman. You're running in sort of like the middle upper. It's not northeastern PA, but it's not central PA. It's kind of in between. If you can see on a map, like a little sliver that goes down from New York straight to like outside of Harrisburg in Reading. Yeah. And so I'm really excited to do this interview. Amanda's been a friend of the pod for several years now. We interviewed her when she was running for state representative back in 2020. So you can go check out that interview. A quick note, just to thank all of our Patreon subscribers. Even though we're just talking, it's not free to produce. So big shout out to everybody that gives to make sure that this pod keeps going and we can still have rural, independent, progressive media here in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is always a battleground state. And podcasts and stations like this really help us connect and get the word out and dig deep into the ideas about how we can foster more democratic rural capacity here in Pennsylvania and broadly too. We have listens from all over the country. So you can support our podcast too by going to barnstormingpa.org and subscribing and donating and also buying some of our merch. We have a great selection there. If you're familiar with hex signs, which, you know, if you've ever driven in Pennsylvania and seen some of the barns, you'll see the hex signs. We have two awesome hex signs that we designed. One is a marijuana leaf hex sign to support legalization in a very Pennsylvania way. The other one has some donkeys and it says elect Democrats. So we have those in t-shirts and totes and mugs. And that's the housekeeping. Welcome to the show, Amanda. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for having me back, Taylor.
Yeah. You've been busy since we last talked, launched a campaign for Congress. I was struggling in the opening about describing the district. Can you, for the listeners, you know, who are not familiar, what is your district? Where are you running in?
So I am running in the 9th District, Pennsylvania, and with the new map drawing, I have 12 counties: Susquehanna, Bradford, Wyoming, Sullivan, Western Luzerne, Eastern Lycoming, Northumberland, Columbia, Montour, Schuylkill, Lebanon, Northern Berks, and I think I got all 12. Apologies if I forgot one.
And I go
from the New York border almost all the way. I'm right outside of Reading is where my district stops.
So the biggest city in there is Williamsport. Isn't that correct? Or is there not?
I'm not sure if it's Williamsport, if it would be Pottsville.
Okay.
I do have all of Schuylkill and Pottsville is the big center in there. Lebanon County, Lebanon City itself is not small. So comparatively, I don't know the exact populations of all of them, but I have a few larger urban areas.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it is very rural.
Okay.
A lot of mountains.
So something on your website that I noticed immediately when I went on there was you have this great, unique political brand, and you say, unbossed, unbought, unapologetic. You also later go on your website to say that you're a candidate that knows how to live paycheck to paycheck. How does your background inform your politics? And as a working class candidate, what do you bring to the table that's often missing from the conversation?
So the unbought, unbossed, unapologetic, I'm just like the people in the district. We are all hardworking Pennsylvanians. We work as many jobs as we need to pay our bills, to take care of our families. to keep a roof over our heads, clothes on our children's backs. In 2020, I woke up one morning and I was just furious. I was furious that all I could find on any news station, and that is left and right, there was no middle, and neither side was giving facts behind the actual issues, how we got to the place we're at right now. And that was in 2020. And it hasn't changed. I decided then to run because I want the people in my district's work to matter. I don't want them to struggling to survive anymore. I would like them to be able to thrive on their hard work. That's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what America is supposed to be about. We can pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, but if our government is cutting off the whole top of our shoe, what bootstrap do we have to pull ourselves up with? I don't take donations from corporate donors. I didn't in 2020. It shows a little bit, I guess, of the naivety of running for Congress and not taking money from corporate PACs and from large dollar donors. They're not my bosses. I don't want their money. I want to work to get some of this money out of Congress. It's been eye-opening. And I do that because I want the people to know that they are my boss. They are who matters to me. And by taking money from large donors that then think they own me and can boss me around and tell me what to vote for and what to vote against, that's not who I am as a person. And my fifth grade teacher even mentioned this when I was collecting signatures to get my name on the ballot to begin with in the primary. And she said, "I am so glad you finally found something to do with that voice of yours."
That's
even
great.
In fifth grade, I mean, I love to learn. I seek knowledge. I went to school and studied English, history, and psychology. I want to know everything there is to know about everything. I worked in the state capitol in 2008 under the lieutenant governor at the time, Catherine Baker Knoll. And so that's where I really experienced policy as written by lawmakers, which to regular people, you look at it and you're like, what is this, legalese? I think it's some form of legalese. But I really learned how to look up the bills, to see who the sponsors are, to what are the pros, what are the cons, how does everything play together? And what's missing the most in a lot of these bills is what happens 5 years from now. What will this piece of legislation look like in 5 years? So,
yeah, things are often a lot more complex than we think. We like to have a very binary view in the world, and we don't like to think about unintended consequences. As you say, 5 years down the road, it's kind of sad to see this mentality.
I've been naturally curious, and I've always been a questioner. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to know the whys and the reasons, and that is what my fifth grade teacher meant by, "I'm so glad you found something to do with that voice," because even with my teachers, I was the one with my hand constantly up in the air, constantly asking questions, constantly pushing back. If it didn't make sense, it didn't make sense. And I'm not the unapologetic part is because I'm not going to apologize to a political party. I'm not going to apologize to a corporation or a lobbyist for standing up for my constituents. They are who matters, and they are the people whose voices are missing in government.
Yeah. So something that drives me really crazy about politics these days in general, and it's like I'm sure that most people feel this way, is that there are a number of policies that I could think of off the top of my head that are very popular but continue not getting done. Like I think about DACA. I think about mandatory background checks on all gun purchases, carbon tax, federal minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. These are things that if you poll them, are wildly popular. Like most people that you meet probably support these things because they're no-brainers. And they tackle real issues in our country. So
it's the money that funds our politicians. That is why these bills don't pass, because the politicians are not listening to you and I.
Yeah.
They're listening to corporations.
Is so when you're out talking with people, are there other issues that you've identified like this? Like, do you feel like there are other issues that are not quite in the Overton window, so to speak, of you know, they haven't reached the upper crust of the political sphere and the media sphere. But there are things that everybody agrees on that are just not getting done. Like, what are some other things that you've encountered while campaigning?
So the vast majority of my district is rural, and it's rural farmland. These are small farms. One of the huge things, and I'm glad you asked this question, my first order of business when elected in November is to change the rules of committees. I'm sure you've heard of the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Veterans Affairs and the Department of Agricultural Committees, like not the department itself, but the committee. The majority and minority chairs of those committees are, they're assigned based on a bidding war. Whoever brings in the most money gets the top seats. The people that control legislation brought to the table in a committee are the ones at the top. So while I can't singularly just take money out of the equation, I can't, you know, just walk in there and force everyone to vote to get dark money out of the way. We wouldn't have Citizen United right now if we were able to do that. But there is, I can get enough support to change the rules of committee. So, okay, we have a corporation that bought a seat. And this isn't part of a campaign finance thing, so you'll never know exactly who owns it. But if we change the rules and make sure that every piece of legislation that goes to a committee must be returned to the House and Senate floor, they can't table it. They can no longer kill a bill. So in relation to farming, the Prime Act, that has been submitted 4 sessions in a row. The Prime Act has huge bipartisan support. Farmers across the country want this legislation passed.
And can you refresh me on what it is? I'm not totally familiar. Yeah.
The Prime Act, it enables, and this is very basic and simplistic, it allows farmers to sell their livestock, like their, to take it to their local butcher to sell it in our regular grocery stores. It removes some of the red tape from the FDA. And right now, with the cost of food and our inflation, the quality of food that we would be able to buy in the grocery store from our local farmers, the cost for them to transport it there is much less. The farmers are getting actual real value for quality product. Because a lot of these farms, the small ones especially, they're organic. So we can now, we can eat healthier. It costs less than something that was, you know, shipped in from California or Iowa or, you know, pick another large farming state, Texas, wherever. We can get it right here from our own backyard, from our own local farmers, many of whom our families have probably been friends for generations. So we're lifting each other up. The money is in our own communities. And that just benefits everyone across the board. That's just one example. And I'm sure you heard the Honoring Our Pact Act with the Burn Pit 360 group and John Stewart.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was another bill that had bipartisan support, and it had the support of the people. Even better than bipartisan politician support, the people wanted this passed. The people support our military members. And that was submitted, and it goes to a committee, and it dies there until you have enough people making enough noise, or you're lucky enough to come across somebody like John Stewart, who just won't shut up and has a huge microphone.
Yeah.
And forces them into it. So, without changing roles of committee, it's not impossible, but it's really difficult to get good legislation that the people support passed.
Yeah, there's kind of two directions that we could go here, and I want to hear more about agriculture stuff, but I also like want to finish off this question of like areas where you've seen like large support for certain policies. And I'm curious here if you think you've identified an issue in the Democratic Party where we've taken it for granted that everybody feels this way, But that's not the case. We've kind of gone out ahead of the voters on. Are there any specific issues that you feel like the Democratic Party has not really taken the popular stance here?
I don't look at a lot of the issues based on party politics and who's getting in front of the cart and who's behind the horse. Like I don't break it down by party, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Obviously I'm a Democrat, but I grew up in a very Republican area. So some people may call me one of the blue dog Democrats, which is apparently a bad word now. It's a bad description. Because I'm able to look at what I personally believe, and then I can compare what I personally believe to what my neighbors believe and what they need. And I can kind of filter that down to what people actually need, not what I personally want to see happen. So Medicare for All, that's a perfect example of this. I would love to see us have Medicare for All and universal healthcare in this country. But I also acknowledge that there's a good portion of this population that doesn't support that. They don't want to be told what healthcare they have to have. They want to make their own choices. I don't blame them. I want to make my own choices. So Medicare for All as a choice, offering Medicare to every single citizen as a choice in healthcare providers, I 100% support that. That should be a choice. If as an elected official, we have fantastic benefits, we should offer a plan that will give the same benefits to the people and let them choose it for themselves and not have to pay astronomical fees or premiums, you know, or costs for specialists. Stop with the hoops and all the red tape. Give the people an option. When they get to make their own choices, if they have a situation where they need to go to Medicare, they're gonna love it. They're gonna save a ton of money. And that's how we can eventually get there. I'm all about taking the first step towards something. So as far as if I've identified anything specific that the Democrats have jumped the horse on, I really couldn't say. Maybe it's the Medicare for All. I know there's a push in certain factions, but it's not necessarily what the majority of the population wants. So
and I think, I mean, you've identified, like, the public option was like supposed to be part of Obamacare, but got nixed, unfortunately.
Right.
Back in,
as did most of our legislators in that session.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some, so I generally like that idea of having a public option. I think it's great policy. And the ability for Medicare to start negotiating the price of drugs, I think is also, that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act. I think that's like great public policy. That's going to make us a healthier country because more people are going to be able to afford the medication that they are prescribed to take. But since you brought up healthcare, I'm curious, what are some other things that you'd like to see to get better access to affordable, high quality healthcare here in America? Big stuff, like you mentioned, and also some small stuff too. Like I've noticed that you're somebody that digs into the rules. So I'm curious if there's some small stuff here.
One of my biggest questions: why did we ever go from a nonprofit healthcare system to a for-profit healthcare system? Why would someone who has insurance, the insurance gets billed a certain dollar amount, but if you don't have insurance, they will cut you a break? It's because those insurance companies don't negotiate their prices for what they're paying for a bag of saline. So when you go into the emergency room and you need to, they hang a bag of saline, because one of the first things they do, because that right there, they can charge $800 for that IV and that bag of solution. If you don't have insurance, you're closer to the real cost, around $75. They cut you a huge break, but insurance companies will pay. So my and I'll use mine as an example. I have a high deductible 90-10 plan. My insurance pays 90% of what they charge. I'm left with 10%. Medicare has negotiated the price. So a specialist visit, my specialist might charge $500 for the visit. When it's billed to Medicare, they're going to charge $500. Medicare is going to be like, sorry, we only approved that service at $100. They're going to pay 80% of that. And you know, the patient is going to pay the remaining 20%. So you're paying $20 for a specialist visit. My insurance, I'm going to pay a lot more than $20 for my 10% of that. Like, that's a $50 charge. And it's simple, like it's simple math that way that when people experience, they'll see. But I'm guilty of this all the time. I try and apply common sense to the government, not recognizing the fact that regular people who use common sense every day are not the ones elected to office who made things not meet up with common sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's that, but also just like this large ship, like in Obama's book that he talked about the government being like basically like a cruise ship that can't move any, you know, can't
turn. They forgot the engine.
Yeah. Well, it can't turn on anything other than like at like, we can go a mile in this direction, you know, over 10 years, you know. So I think there's just a lot of like institutional stuff that keeps the government from being as responsive as people want. Yeah. But I don't want to be an apologist for a slow government either.
It's not about being slow. It's about not applying common sense to a problem. So you and I, in our everyday regular lives, we come across all kinds of problems that we have to come up with a solution for. Oh, I have to get my car inspected. Inspection is due in 2 months. I know I'm going to need 4 tires and probably at least 1 set of brakes, if not, you know, all the way around the car. I know what that costs. I can pick up the phone, call the garage, say, hey, I know I'm going to need this stuff. What is this? You know, how much are these things going to cost? And then I have to figure out where that money's coming from. I solve my own problem by either picking up extra hours at a second job or cutting bills, unnecessary ones, living within my means. You and I do it every day. Why is it so complicated when we get to government? That's, you know, local, state, and federal. Why all of a sudden does common sense go out the window? Why are we like, oh, well, I don't really feel like cutting the expenses. I don't really feel like having to deal with it. I'm just going to spend the money and put it on credit. And then I'm going to hope and pray and hold up bright, shiny objects to distract my constituents with, so that they don't question me on why I'm not using common sense to solve the problems or why things they actually need aren't being done. I'm just over here yelling and whining and pointing fingers and passing the buck. Like with healthcare, think of anyone you know over the age of 65 who has Medicare. What is their reaction when they hear politicians threaten to cut Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security? They lose their minds.
Yeah, these
they
are
lose their minds.
Bedrock programs that really,
that we paid for. We already paid. You and I both paid in for this. Want to cut it so that we don't have it when we're 65? No, I don't.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
How can the federal government help curtail inflation and make it better for working people?
So, I do love the inflation discussion.
Yeah.
So inflation is a natural part of every economy. There are going to be ups and there are going to be downs. The goal is to keep it steady, to keep it flat. And slow increases over time. One of the biggest drivers to inflation is gas prices. So, you know, this funny thing happened in March of 2020, where the entire country shut down for COVID. We had a pandemic. And in April of 2020, the president at the time, Trump, spoke with OPEC nations as well as producers in the United States, and had them, these are the gas and oil producers, had them cut production by 20 million barrels per day because demand plummeted. People weren't driving to work anymore. Some of us were lucky and we were working from home, but we weren't going anywhere. So we had to stabilize the oil market. Fast forward to Biden is elected, the economy's opening back up, everyone's going back to work in person, demand goes through the roof. Production is still down here. Demand is now up here. And instead of everyone jumping on board and producing what they used to before COVID, they stayed down here. So we had a few things happening. We had an insane increase in gas prices. Then all of the fake news about Biden trying to cozy up to Saudi Arabia, I believe was one of the headlines I saw in April when he went to Saudi Arabia to talk to them and to the United Arab Emirates about increasing production back up to where they should be instead of keeping it artificially low. There's a House resolution. It's been sitting in the Foreign Affairs Committee, which my opponent, Dan Musser, sits on that committee. It's been sitting there since May to do the very thing that we need done, which is increase production. The United States, our producers here are still not producing at full capacity. They're still not 100% open. They were doing maintenance and cleaning and blah, blah, talking points. And coupled with that was price gouging. And I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form that a gas station was price gouging. The companies themselves are selling oil to these gas stations. They're selling that gas at an inflated cost. Gas stations aren't making fistfuls of money. Oil companies are. And traveling through my 12 counties and having it be such a long, narrow, you know, stretch of 12 counties, I saw the gas prices range from $5.09 in the far north tier, northern tier, down to still $4.29 in the most southern tier. That is not inflation. That is price gouging. You don't have 80, 90 cent differences in price because of inflation. 5, 10, 15 cents maybe. That's normal inflation. 80 and 90%, that is you are being ripped off by companies that don't need more money. And I'm sure everyone has seen the reports on how much money they made, those oil companies made during COVID. If you cut production by 20 million barrels a day, how are you making money hand over fist? And why is gasoline still $3.99 a gallon here in Lycoming County? That's the cheapest.
In talking with different voters across your district, Pennsylvania is a very diverse state. You know, we have lots of different groups of people and people employed in different industries. How do you connect with them? How do you connect with people that don't necessarily share your background to create unbreakable solidarity?
I just have conversations with people like they're human.
Yeah.
I have seen a significant lack of recognizing each other as people first. In 2020, I was baffled by conversations I would have where people, we connected on all the issues, we connected on all the solutions. And we connected on not trusting the other guy to be in government. And yet, on election day, they voted for a letter of the alphabet instead of the person in front of them and what you had in common. So I've been focused on that ever since the 2020 election, is trying to really connect on everything we have in common, because our differences are minuscule. Sometimes they seem huge and insurmountable. But when you really get into the day-to-day life and the kitchen table issues, we all have the same ones. And we all agree across the board we don't trust politicians. Politicians, that is not a good name to be called. That's a great insult now.
I am just really curious. I mean, this brings up like a great point. Like, what are we polarized about? Like, I don't actually understand what the fundamental thing is that we're so, that's driving us to be so polarized. And I don't get that.
There is a specific political party that their members, their elected members, spin every issue based in fear. So fear is a huge motivator in humans. And when you can spin every single issue and make someone afraid that their entire life is being destroyed or will be destroyed by another political party. And of course, like I'm saying here, Republicans only speak fear. Everything they say is based in you should be afraid of this. They're going to take your guns. I hate to tell you, I'm a Democrat and I own guns. My gun cabinet is right beside me. I learned to hunt with my grandfather and my dad. I learned how to take care of a weapon. I learned how to shoot. I'm a really great marksman. And ever since that, the first utterance of Democrats are going to take your guns, Democrats have controlled the House and the Senate and the White House. And guess what? Nobody came and took your guns. Because we're not going to take your guns. It's not what the argument is about. The conversation is about protecting our children. When we put them on the school bus to go to school, to get an education so they can grow up and they can be whatever they dream of being. They can follow their own personal American dream for themselves. That we don't have to pray and worry all day long that somebody who never should have been allowed to own a gun managed to get their hands on one and murdered an entire classroom full of students and teachers. That's what the conversation is about. The argument happens when the NRA sticks their nose in and the politicians that they've bought and paid for start screaming and yelling, Democrats are going to take your guns. Protect your Second Amendment. Another FYI, Second Amendment says well-regulated militia. What part of an absence of regulations equals well-regulated?
Yeah, I'd never really thought about it that way.
I know lots of veterans, and all of them agree, a lack of regulation does not equal well-regulated. They're not the same thing.
That's fair.
We're not taking anything from you. We're trying to protect your right to own that weapon. We're trying to protect the rights of law-abiding citizens, not by taking your weapons, but by making it harder for criminals to get them, or people who are having a mental health issue, illness, you know, episode. I'm not saying that's a lifelong thing, but those happen. And if people, they'll jump to a conclusion and they just want to end their life and they're going to take out whatever they see is causing that pain for them. Why people choose a school, I will never understand that. What first, second, third graders have to do with the problems of an almost adult, I don't know.
Would you have, if you had been in the House, would you have voted for the most recent gun safety bill that came through?
I actually, when I decided to run for Congress, I jumped to the federal issues. I do support the red flag laws. They're extreme risk protection acts. And I support that because I am a huge supporter of our veterans. And veterans now today, without these ERPA laws or the red flag laws, as everyone's calling them, without those in place, if a veteran seeks help for a mental health issue, they lose their weapons. The VA sends a report that says this person is incompetent, they are seeking mental health issues, whatever it is. But there is no reverse of that. So once the VA labels you that way and notifies the authorities, there's no way to reverse it. They don't get to go back to the same authorities and say, okay, they've sought treatment, everything's great, they've been good, they can have their weapons back. I know this personally. My best friend's ex-husband now had an episode. And at the same time, he's manic. And you know, bipolar when I say manic. And he had an episode. At the same time he was seeking treatment, he was also declared financially incompetent at the time. So if anyone knows anything about bipolar, you have cycles. Usually in mania, you overspend. So his wife took care of the finances. That diagnosis from the VA cost him all of his weapons. He's a gunsmith. He went to school after his service. He lost everything. And it was an error, and there was no way to fix it. I know that Senator Casey's office has been working with him and getting everything straightened out. And as far as I know, he will be able to get them back. But why should any veteran choose to suffer alone and in silence because they're afraid to lose the weapons that they were trained to carry, that they're passionate about, when they could simply be held while they seek treatment? They don't have to worry about them being gone. And when treatment is up, they have everything back. No red tape, no hoops to jump through, no years and years and years of battling with the VA and with law enforcement to get your own weapons back. So,
let's talk about your opponent. Dan Muser is not somebody that's been in office for very long, I think just two terms. What's the biggest difference between the two of you?
Everything.
Well, if you could whittle it down though, what do you think? You know, you have 30 seconds. Tell me the biggest difference between the two of you.
I'm not bought and paid for by corporate lobbyists. I will never fall in line with party mouthpieces. I will never do anything that is not in 100% best interest of my constituents. Congressman has done all of those things, and you can see it in his votes. So I'm going to go again to veterans with the PACT Act. This came up for a vote in March. He voted against it in March. I believe the date was either March 2nd or 3rd of this year. He voted no, because the entire Republican Party said, oh my gosh, if we cover veterans service-related illnesses, we're going to balloon the deficit. A couple days later, they voted for the biggest increase to the Department of Defense budget in history. So it's either veterans' lives don't matter, or, you know, the deficit is really a big issue. Then Congressman Muser paid nearly $700,000, and I've gone through the finance reports, almost $700,000 to multiple political consulting firms to tell him it was a really horrible idea to vote against veterans. So when it came up for the second vote, he voted in favor of it. So kudos for learning and listening to the people you paid to tell you what your constituents need. The congressman already serves 70% of this district. And the fact that he had to spend such exorbitant amounts of money to find out what his constituents needed, to find out what was wrong with his website, to find out how he should vote, is unconscionable. It's because he's so far removed from regular people. He has no idea what happens at our kitchen table. He has no idea the stress that parents are under trying to figure out how we're going to pay for daycare when we pick up that second job. So now we're not even going to be home at night while our kids are in school during the day. How we're going to pay this month's electric bill. Because this was a really, you know, July was god awful hot. And we had the air conditioners running, which is something I don't usually do. But it was so hot. We had to, and I have two dogs, so air conditioning was kind of vital for them. And I struggled with that electric bill. I had to look at everything else and cut everything so that I could make sure that we were comfortable and safe in our own home. Do you know how many families didn't even have the option of cutting anything else? He has no idea that that even happens. Or we have our own vegetables. We have a garden here. My son has a green thumb. Just keep it mild. But because of the drought and the lack of rain, we didn't have a whole lot of vegetables coming in. And we have squirrels and chipmunks who happen to love tomatoes. So while we got a lot of tomatoes, they didn't make it into the house because they were eaten by the squirrels and the chipmunks. We could watch them just every day run in like it was an apple and they're scampering off through the yard with it. He's out of touch. He's not one of the people. He doesn't even live in the 9th district. He's just outside it in Wilkes-Barre. He spends his time at country clubs and on golf courses, meeting with wealthy donors and big business. He does not have our backs. He'll say he does. He said it quite often, but he's never there.
So wrapping up the interview now, I just have two more questions. One is, can you name a book that you read that made a big impact on your life?
America and Americans, John Steinbeck. That had a huge impact. And also East of Eden. So full disclosure, one of my dogs is named Steinbeck because he's one of my favorite authors.
I see.
And those books, they made an impact on me. The way they painted American life. The reality of the Depression. I know everyone knows Grapes of Wrath, and I promise you, not everything by John Steinbeck is the Grapes of Wrath, so really explore him if you haven't. A lot of his other novels are much shorter, much more succinct, still descriptive, but not, you know, to put a 16-year-old to sleep kind of thing. I like to read. It's one of my favorite hobbies is going to thrift stores and going to like old antique stores and used bookstores.
Same here, actually. That's one of my favorite things to do.
I collect old civics books. So basically what was taught in civics class in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Believe it or not, they actually used to teach every student minute detail on how government works from the local level, you know, your township supervisors all the way up to president, who was in control of what.
We badly need that because people are very misinformed as to who has power and what types of power people actually have and all that kind of stuff.
And watching the change over the decades, you know, watching the books being rewritten because, you know, there were certain laws that were applied or removed or new regulations, things like that. So watching that progression over time, it's the history nerd in me.
The last question here is our junk drawer question. What's one thing that you have in your junk drawer that you think everybody else should have? And something that you have way too much of that you don't need to have in your junk drawer, but it's there and you can't get rid of it. And here we are.
So you know how, no matter what point in time, anytime you're looking for a pencil or a pen, you can never find one. My junk drawer has probably 200 pencils, all remaining sizes, you know, from the little stubs that are left to, you know, brand new ones that haven't been sharpened. Do you think I can get any of them to write when I need them to? No, because the ones that are already sharpened, the tip breaks off.
That's time. Classic.
Or I can't find the pencil sharpener. Well, that's what I have too much of. What do I have that is just random?
Is that kind of you would, maybe it could be like, you know, like a tool that you found that you should, yeah. Something you may have discovered, so, you know.
So my dad passed away back in 2010. And so I got to go through his junk drawer. And I found this little, it was a tin circle about like this and has a four-leaf clover on the top. And when I picked it up, the bottom pops off. And it's a cup. It's a drinking cup, an expandable drinking cup to take with you anywhere.
That's awesome.
So it was one of his fun finds. And now that's in my junk drawer. As just a memento, I'll never get rid of that. But I think everyone should have those along with a life straw.
Okay.
The life water. Yeah.
I know what that is. It's like the, it's like a real plastic straw. So you don't have to use the disposable plastic.
No, the straw, the filter straw, the filtration straw. So if you're out camping or, you know, like you can use it in a,
it has like charcoal in it or something.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. Awesome. Yes. Noted. Thank you so much for coming on the pod. Where can people follow your campaign?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and in TikTok, but I haven't made a TikTok video yet. I'm just, I still feel too old. And I'm afraid to make one of those, you know, old people mistakes on the TikTok. But that's Waldman, the number 4, PA. And my website is Waldman, the numeral 4, at PA, Waldman, the number 4, PA.com.
All right, excellent. Thanks for coming on the pod. All right, yeah.